Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yes, indeed. And this is episode number 97.
Woo!
And we are going to talk about a book called In This House of Breed, B-R-E-D-E, by Rumer Godden, which was one heck of a good book.
Oh, I'm glad you liked it.
Yes, I did. Very much. Very much.
Had you heard of Rumer Godden before?
I had not.
Okay.
And I was really surprised to see. Yeah, I'm looking on Wikipedia, and she's written like, what, 30 books?
Yeah.
Something like that? Yeah, I had not heard of her.
She was really prolific, and when you start looking, she wrote books like this, which are novels for adults. She wrote some children's books, which are super. If you find them at your library, just check them out. The stories in them are just as good as this.
Wow.
And then she wrote some, what I guess now you'd call them YA novels, which also are really great.
Nice. Yeah, it looks like she started in 1936 and was writing in 1996.
Yeah, wow, she kept going along. No wonder she has 30 books.
Looks like she passed on in 1998.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this book, I would say, is probably her best-known book. For one thing, it was a BBC production with Diana Rigg, which I understand they changed the story around a lot. So more people have heard of this than any other. And I came across it because it was at my home when I was growing up. And it's funny because I mentioned it to my mother last week and I said, so you had this book? And she goes, what? I don't even remember that name. I don't. And she's got a good memory. So she wasn't aware of it, but I always saw it lying around. So I read it several times before I even became Christian. And there are a lot of people out there. I was telling you before we started, Joe Walton at Tor.com has reviewed it.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny how many people know about this book for it being a book and her being an author that no one knows about.
Well, it's interesting that you read it and liked it as a non-Christian.
Oh, yeah.
What did you find it touching? What did you find it moving in any way? Or did you?
Oh, well, just the story and the interwoven stories of all the characters and the fact that they are contemplative nuns living in an enclosed society was really interesting. I mean, I didn't think of it as being weird or anything. You know, I just, in a sense, it was kind of like a science fiction novel where, oh, here we are in this world.
Hmm.
And here's how they do things. And so, for example, I realized when I was reading through it this time and thinking of it in the context of the podcast, this is where I learned about the liturgical calendar year. So when it came up in RCIA, when I was taking classes, I was like, oh, yeah. I mean, I'd already been going, so I knew about it. But that never surprised me because she's very emphatic about how that's woven through these nuns' lives.
She writes beautifully about that.
Well, and there's another book that she wrote about nuns called Five for Sorrow, Ten for Joy, and that's also dwelt on greatly there, too.
Wow. Is that worthwhile as well?
Oh, my gosh. It's amazing.
Okay, cool.
It is definitely amazing.
It's on my list. I've got to read it.
Yeah. It's set in France.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things this author does, and eventually I'll mention what the book's about more, but one of the things this author is really good at, and you see it in most of her books to some degree or other, is she plays with time a lot. And when I say plays with time, it makes it sound as if it's very artificial.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the way I think about it, you know, she's always going back and forth and she'll be telling you about something that's happened. And then one of the characters will say, oh yeah, I remember I thought this at the time. And somebody else might say something, and then they go right back into the story. So it's almost like listening to someone tell you a story that you're imagining. Hmm. I don't know if you got that feeling.
I did get that feeling. Yeah, she does some flashbacks in this book, you know, a few. And you do get the feeling that you're listening to someone tell that flashback rather than being in the flashback.
Well, and she also kind of just flows into it a lot. Yeah. It's not always really, here's a new section, here's the flashback. It's just kind of flows in and back out again sometimes. And a book that I read on Forgotten Classics, the estate allowed me to read the book, was China Court. And that's just about an old house and the family that's been in it for a long time. But that really goes back and forth in time a lot.
Hmm.
And it's really interesting how she always kind of just falls into it, you feel like.
Yeah, that's cool.
So, but this is about a woman, very professional, high-level government woman who decides to become a contemplative nun when she's 40. And it stuns everyone because she was going to be maybe a government minister or assistant or something like that, probably. And she gives up everything. And it's written in 1957, I think. And that's about the time this is told, or the time this book starts anyway, or maybe a few years before that. And so it's telling about her as she goes through the process of becoming a nun. And you learn about all the different people in the community. And there's a mystery in it. There's a mystery about her past. There is a big mystery about, I don't know what you say, about kind of how the place is being run.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny because it's hard to describe.
Yeah, it is a little bit difficult to describe, but it is really engaging. There's never a slow moments where I'm like, oh, I wish this would get on with it. I never felt that way. There was always something going on, and there's lots of subplots and things going on with the different characters and their pasts. And it's interesting how, you know, everybody arrived there, you know.
Yeah.
And several of them were discussed that way. And especially the main character that you said, her, who was given the name Philippa, right?
Mm-hmm.
And her discernment, and we don't quite see at the beginning why she decided to do it, you know. And, right. And it was interesting, some of the questions that she was asked. Excuse me, like, you know, why are you doing this? You know, is it because you got divorced or something like that? You know, I remember a few of the questions she was asked, and she was like, no, that, you know, this is what I want to do, or this is what I feel called to do, is probably the correct answer, right?
Right.
But yet it's not finished at that point. You know, once she starts in that life, there's questions all the time, you know, why am I doing this? Is this right thing to do? And, am I worthy of this? Lots of that kind of thing.
Well, and there are several people who you follow fairly closely. Cicely is another one who comes from a completely different sort of a situation, but she also is having to really struggle with, am I here or am I not? And sometimes it's the people in the community who are watching them going, I don't think they're quite ready, but I don't exactly know how to push it so that this person will be able to tell if they're ready or not.
Yeah.
And so that all sounds really boring, but what happens is because it's a community and you get to know all these people, and of course in the life of the community, you know, things happen. Someone dies, someone has to be elected to take their place, things move along in that way, so that you learn all the personalities. And by the middle of the book, when Sister Veronica comes up, you're just rolling your eyes already going, oh, not Sister Veronica. Oh, man, she drives me crazy. And I know that I've heard many a time that this book is one that is often given by monks, brothers, or sisters in the religious life to people who say, what's it like to be in a religious order, and they give this book.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, because Rumor Godden lived for, I think it was 2 years at the little gatehouse of a contemplative community in England while she was researching the book.
Oh.
And after that time period, she converted to Catholicism.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know
that. And
I
should have
gone
and looked it up. But
yeah, very nice.
Yeah, but you know that she could only talk to them through the grill, just like everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
But they gave her their time, and she wrote this really beautiful book. And the thing I like about it is there are urgent storylines that you just really want to read. And at the same time, to me anyway, and I'll be curious to know what you think, it's also kind of almost got a leisurely pace as she'll step out and talk about, oh, here's the liturgical year, now they're making honey, or, you know, a sculptor comes to do some things and they watch him as he sculpts and talking about that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think she's maybe capturing some of the pace of the life, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would make decisions like, okay, this is your new job or something like that. And the person often would say, you have selected the exact wrong person to do this. And, you know, yes. I mean, that would happen. And then somehow through the doing it, they understand, you know, why. So that slowing down of the pace of the book, I think, is maybe a mimicking of that process that, you know, we get some downtime to take in what's happened so that we're prepared for the next thing, which, again, you know, is what the liturgical calendar does for us, too, which she mentions at least three times beautifully. Like I said, I thought that was really neat.
I think there might be a whole chapter that kind of takes them through the liturgical year as other pieces of the story are being kind of dropped in there as you go.
Yeah, yeah.
But the point that you made about the people saying, whoa, I'm never going to be able to do this or whatever, and they'll find new strength, or they'll find aspects of themselves they hadn't discovered, or it will help them learn to know other people better who they've been struggling with. And one of the things I appreciated this time through the book is that, and this point is made to Philippa a couple of times, because she'll be lamenting, oh, I've got to stop being so pushy, I've got to stop being so forward, I have to stop doing this. And she'll be talking to somebody who says, well, no, you can't stop being you. You're a natural leader. The question is, how do you do the leading? Who are you letting lead? Or are you pushing forward somehow? And so the point is not to change yourself into someone else, but to be more fully yourself without the flaws. And how do you do that? You have to give up part of yourself. You have to let go. And in the being obedient is when, as they would say, you become the instrument for strength as it flows through you.
Right. And we see that in both Philippa's life and Cecily's life, you know, in a completely different way, because they're so different, right?
Yeah.
And Cecily showed up, you know, she's beautiful. She's got everything going for her. Guy wants to marry her really bad. And she's like, well, no, I'm going to do this. And everybody's questioning, well, why are you doing this? And they don't quite believe her, but you know, you watch her grow throughout the book. That was a really captivating story, I thought. And, so it's exactly what you're saying about, you know, vocation, really, is what we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
So,
And it makes it sound as if they're cut off from the world, too, and that's a point that keeps being made continually throughout the book, is they're not cut off from the world. Those bars in their contemplative order's walls are there to keep people out, not to shut themselves away from it. They're to allow them to do the work they're supposed to do without being so interrupted. But people still are calling them, and at that time telegraphing them and coming to visit them. And so what you see is through their interaction with people like Penny, who was Philippa's like assistant secretary back in her old days outside.
She
starts coming to her for advice and with problems, and her problems can be very big. And
And one interesting before you go on, that I remember someone saying in the book that be sure to give them everything in the parlor time. They were like, it was like, don't hold back. Give them everything that they need.
Yeah.
And I thought that was fascinating, you know, because they're contemplative nuns, you know, people just naturally come to them with these problems, and they're expecting wisdom, you know?
Right.
And the nuns often can give that to them. And I just find that that's really something.
Well, and the way the nuns do it, though, is not by being obviously wise, unless you're a young woman coming to an older one who might have a different perspective, which is obviously going to be the case, but sometimes it's just through the fully listening.
Right. Being fully there. Right.
Yeah. Being fully present to the person that things come up.
Mm.
So, and one of the things they said about being shut away from the world, they're early on in the book, there's a young, vibrant brother, a monk, I guess he is, he comes and he's doing missionary work. And he's talking to them and telling them about, you know, being in India, I think it is. And the young ones are getting all really excited. And he says, you know, "I don't like to see these," Brother John had said, tapping the grill of the parlor. "I look forward to the day when the bars will come down and you can mingle freely with your guests, perhaps even wear lay clothes as they do." "Just as we did 100 years ago," said the young counselor, Dame Catherine Ismay. That took him aback. And so then they talk about the fact that they had to be in disguise when they came back, because being Catholic in England at the time they did, their order did, they would have been in big trouble. It took them a long time to get to the point where they could have an obvious convent and wear their habits.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, and so he's saying, "Well, it takes you away from your proper work." And she goes, and somebody says, "Well, that supports you." And he says, "Our Lord taught and healed." "Do you not believe in prayer?" asked Dame Colette. "Of course, but if you are shut away, it must be limited." "Or concentrated," said Dame Catherine Ismay. "Brother John, you want to be a missionary," said Dame Agnes. "Then you might reflect, brother, that the greatest missionary of modern times was and is little Saint Therese of Lisieux, who never even for 5 minutes left her cloister."
Hmm. Yeah. Very nice.
And it's,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, you need both. But,
right.
But we're always really ready to recognize doing and being active.
Mm-hmm.
And they make the point also that in prayer, you can't always be practical. Everything doesn't have to be, necessary or utilitarian.
Mm-hmm.
You right. have to leave room for the stuff that isn't utilitarian.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's one of the things I love about the Catholic Church so much, is that there are these people in it. You know mm-hmm. what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, that this life is considered valuable is a sign of truth, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Yeah, I thought that was cool. I mean, all of the nuns were getting called to the parlor for, you know, by various people, and sometimes it was exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were like, "Oh, I just want to get back. I want to get back inside." You know, and pray. It's fantastic. And then the abbess as well. I wrote some about 159. The abbess at the beginning of the book. Are we in spoiler territory yet?
Probably so.
Probably so. You bet. Please read this book if you haven't.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really hard to describe Rumor Garden's books. It's like me saying China Court is a book about a big house and a family that lived there for generations, and you go, ugh. But she takes these characters, all these characters become alive to you, and their stories are fascinating, and she's weaving these bigger overarching stories in there too. And so the religious stuff is because she's writing about this religious house, and even if you're not interested in Catholicism necessarily, you know, I'm thinking about all the people who love this book, and including me before I ever thought about being Christian. I remember rereading it, being stunned, going, "Wow, I missed a lot of stuff in there."
Nice. You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
So you would recommend China Court as well?
Oh, yeah.
And the other one was Five for Sorrow, Ten for Joy.
And yeah. Then some that are China Court is not about anything religious.
Mm-hmm.
And then their Thursday's Children is about dancing and children. An episode of Sparrows. She really loves gardening and gardens, as you could tell from this book. She loves dancing and music. And so a lot of her books are focused around that. And she may have trained as a ballerina. I can't remember.
Wow.
The Didikoi is for younger readers, but it's about gypsies And Miss Happiness and Miss Flower is one of the most enchanting children's books you're ever going to read. About two Japanese dolls who are stuck in England.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she's got an interest in Japan too, huh?
Yeah, right. And she may have lived there. Well, she grew up in India. And her sister was also a writer, though I never read any of her stuff. John, J-O-N, Godden. But they were part of that British Raj sort of thing. You know, what you said, born in 39? Or wrote her first book in 39.
Right. She was born in 1907 and died in 1998.
Yeah, so she grew up at the end of that empire period.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
Cool. Yeah. But yeah, so yeah, I've got some more books to read.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
You were saying, though, and I...
Yeah, but I was just wanting to talk about the abbess. Right. Mm-hmm. And how she... our abbess, I'm on page 159, and Dame Claire is speaking. Our abbess, we believe, is the representative of Christ, God. It is in her name, abbess, from Abba, Father. That is why we hold her in such reverence, kneel to her, make the deep bow when we pass her meter, and she will be abbess for life, said Cecily. It must be terrifying. That whole story about the abbess, I think her name was Hester.
Abbess Hester, and
right.
Then
and the then replacement. She passes away, and then, man, I felt Catherine's pain.
Oh.
That was really rough. So Catherine is elected to be the next abbess, and she is just like, no, please God, no. And they elected her in a very similar fashion to the way they elect the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
So the nuns vote, and then she's finally selected after several ballots.
Right.
And that's an amazing process. I mean, to read that and how that happens, that was fascinating to me. And then how someone can kind of at the beginning be really not somebody who they were thinking of end up being the one. That reminded me of maybe Pope Benedict. I know a lot of people thought Benedict was going to get elected, and then he ended up being elected, but he really just didn't want that. He just wanted the books.
Oh my gosh, his books.
Yeah, so...
He's been trying to get away for so long.
Imagine that he was thinking the very same thing. Like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you do it.
Yeah, after she's elected and she's realizing, oh, I'm not going to have those times going to get the hot water in the bathroom and running to people. I'm not going to have all these things and, you know, these connections with people. Because part of the problem with the old abbess is that she used bad judgment.
Mm-hmm.
She had favorites.
She was beloved, right, but used bad judgment, right?
Yeah, well, she was beloved, and she was really good in a lot of things, and you kind of tend to forget that toward the end of the book when you see what effect that all had. And so you kind of forget that she was great for so long.
Right,
it's just we all have our flaws, and if your favorites are going to let you, you know, she picked people like Dame Veronica, who was very weak, and she picked her because she was weak.
Yep.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So
now, Veronica was her she did the books, right?
Right.
Yeah, okay. So I'm just trying to remember for sure which one was
she
which.
She did the books, and so she was the one who, when she was, because Abbess Hester had an artistic background, and so she wanted to restore all the stone at the abbey, and everybody's like, but, you know, in the meantime, we're using a box as a step to go to and from our printing press with big, heavy rolls of paper. And,
yeah, yeah.
You know, so it was an obsession that should have been checked somehow. But she managed to put people in just the right places who kind of went, well, let's let her have this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And nobody else knew it.
And then she passes away, and nobody else knew it until... the sculptor wrote a letter and said, hey, I'm going to be here, you know, in a couple of weeks.
to install this.
I'm going to need some space. I'm going to need this and about $4,000.
Like, what? Well, the other thing was, how agonizing was that when she was dying?
Yeah.
She's holding on for days and she's had that stroke, and then all she can say is sorry.
Right.
Sorry, over and over, and they don't know why, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was the mystery you were talking about.
Yeah.
That slowly becomes apparent. But yeah, and that's something that's kind of neat about the book. You know, she says that and she passes away, and then everybody kind of gets on, you know, once things settle and they're moving on, and then boom, you know, later in the book, we find out why, you know, she was sorry.
Why she was so sorry.
Just like what reading this letter done. Is like, oh.
Well, wow. And the other thing too, though, is interesting is because they are just trying to rack their brains and think of any way they can come up with this money, and you know, there's no one they can borrow from and all this sort of thing. And then there's a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
But the miracle is nothing that anybody is ever able to explain.
Yeah.
You either accept it as a miracle or you don't. And there are several times in the book where it's really obvious there's some other movement going on. Like when Philip is the only other person to get the measles
mm-hmm.
at the same time as, I can't remember her name, but mm-hmm. the girl she'd been avoiding.
Right, right.
Was the daughter of the old nurse, or the nurse of her child before. And so that's when she's like covered with spots and she's like, what are you laughing at? My puny little self. Because she knows exactly.
Yeah.
But it's never, but it's always something that you either know what's going on or you could take it the other way.
Right. Yeah.
Which actually kind of makes me think of something I read about the new movie Exodus that's coming out, mm-hmm. Ridley Scott's Exodus. They said some, there's always people going to complain before they see it, but they said some people are complaining because he being, I don't think he's atheist. I guess he could be agnostic. But anyway, he is making sure that there's a realistic explanation for all the plagues that hit.
Okay.
And I'm like, okay. You mean to tell me that these 10 realistic play or however many plagues hitting mm-hmm. right in a row on cue naturally is not something else going on too? I'll take it however it happens. You know, yeah, I don't mean to say I'm reading in, but when someone says this is going to happen and then it happens, it doesn't matter what made it happen. Something moved those things for that to happen.
Exactly right. Yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise they go, oh, but it's 7 plague time. Of course it's going to happen because it happens regularly.
Yep.
So anyway, that's the kind of thing, though, that's going on in the book. And
mm-hmm.
We all know what's going on. And that's the thing that got me. I was telling you when Jo Walton reviewed this book, she said, well, it's a fantasy because a miracle happens. And I was like, you know, even when I didn't believe in anything, I just accepted that as part of this book, they were miracles. I knew what was going on. I didn't feel like I had to label something as a fantasy.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I need to read that review, and that's on Tor, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm,
we'll put a link. We'll put a link to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fascinating. Fascinating. Another storyline that really captured me, before we talk more about Philippa was Cecily.
Yes.
She was constantly fascinating because, you know, I certainly didn't think she was going to make it.
You know, really?
Yeah, I really didn't think so. I guess I didn't really trust that. And I think that this was rumor gotten really did a good mm-hmm. job with her. I really didn't trust that she knew what she wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah, ever really up until a certain point near the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
When she really made the decision. And then she changed. It changed everything for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it made her suddenly face what she was really giving up and that she deliberately had to know the cost of what she was sacrificing in order to choose this different way of living.
Right, right.
And that was Philippa makes a beautiful little speech about that when she's talking to some of the girls because she's been married before. And had a child who died. And she says, you know, I'm like somebody where the farmer has an orchard and he picks up the windfalls and he puts them all in a basket and takes them in. Some of them are bruised, some of them aren't, but they're not perfect.
Hmm.
You're like, you know, the orchard in bloom. You're perfect. You're giving up something that you haven't lived life and gotten knocked around. You're offering the first fruits. But Cecily never realized what the first fruits were,
mm-hmm.
which is why the other nuns kept kind of hesitating, going, there's something not quite right. We don't know what it is.
Right.
You know, because she was too perfect.
Mm-hmm. And then she finally understood. That was a good moment when she mm-hmm. was in there and went to the parlor to see that guy. And touched. I mean, she grabbed the bars. I remember that in my head. You know, he had his hands out, and she grabs the bars.
Yeah.
You know, and she's like, "That's the moment." I said, "Okay, she's decided."
Well, I loved it when she was talking to his mother,
mm-hmm.
who came.
No, that was who she was talking to. Right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's right. She had come to ask him.
Grabbing the bars moment, and I didn't remember because a lot of people come to see her.
Right, right.
And it's after, I thought Penny's baby at one point grabs a finger, and that also kind of makes her, jolts her alive.
Right, and that was before that.
That's what, right, mm-hmm. that's what starts her thinking, I could have babies. I could still leave.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we'd be having tea, and, you know, there are servants, and because he was rich, too.
Yeah.
And then when, you know, the mother comes to talk, you know, please put my son out of his agony, come out of there and marry him. And she has to go really think about it. And she suddenly really puts herself into the life that she's on one hand longing for, because they live a life that is hard. They live like Mother Teresa's people live. They mm-hmm. live like the poor.
Right. Yep, they do.
They're always saying the poor don't have this. So yes, you have to wash, but you have a basin of water and a washcloth, and here you go. Stand in front of the fire, whatever, strip off and do it.
Yep.
No shower for you.
Yeah, I remember after Philippa was sick, the doctor said, okay, you need to go take a hot bath and change into fresh clothes and wash those other ones.
Right.
And that was the first time she had taken a bath like that for a long, long, long time.
Years since she'd been there. Right. Yeah.
So, yeah. Right. Yeah, Cecily deciding it. And that's a, you know, as Christians, you know, we make that decision too. It's not as drastic mm-hmm. as hers or anything, but that decision is something that we all make. Right?
Yeah.
You know, and so in a way.
In the same way that it's shown in all these people living in this community, we constantly have to decide every day, are we going to do what we should? Or are we going to do what we want?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, whether it's, I don't know, doing something nice like emptying the dishwasher without saying anything to your spouse.
Mm-hmm.
Just because. Almost as a gift, but not because it's a gift, but because you should do it. You're there. You have the time or whatever.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah. Yep. Decisions serving. Like that every day. Right. And then the idea of the cloistering too is interesting. I don't know. In a way, Christians are cloistered, right? I mean, just as a whole. You know, just in a way.
Well, we have to guard our own hearts and our own selves by, and you know, I make fun of people. I'll just say it. I make fun of people who get rid of their TVs. But if that's what you have to do, then that's what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
We all have different things we have to do in order to kind of put those walls up to make ourselves able to concentrate on what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And that's interesting. You know, the walls of the place is keeping people out, right? Rather than keeping people in. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's kind of what we do, huh? You know, it just, you know, in a small way, I'm just thinking about it.
Yeah.
You know, well, there's a separation, and I guess that's what the cloister can represent. The separation
may be. There's a part that I really felt hit me this time around that they emphasize all the time on being fit to give.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're always having to give and be obedient. But you have to be fit to do it. And they say there was always this emphasis on giving, being fit to give. A monastery convent is not a refuge for misfits or a dumping ground for the unintelligent, Abbess Hester had often said, nor for a rebound from an unhappy love affair. Though a broken heart can often find healing in one of the active orders, it will not do for us. And then Dame Ursula says, anyone who comes here with the idea of getting something is bound to fail. And that's not exactly what you're talking about, but I liked it because it went to the point of, it's not what am I going to get out of this? Although you should be getting something because it's part of your relationship with Christ as a person. And you get things from your relationships. But you shouldn't be coming to it going, what am I going to get?
Yeah.
You know? Does that make sense?
It sure does. It sure does. And
I mean, sometimes you need like healing or you need, and you're going to get, you know, some sort of that. But you have to work for it too sometimes.
Yeah, right, right. Now, wasn't it Philippa at right when she got there, very soon after she got there, somebody said, we need you to do this or something like that. And wasn't it her who said, I didn't think I had anything to give? Or was that a different nun? I don't remember. I don't know if
that was her or not.
Yeah, but regardless of who it was, that was an interesting time too. You know, something that we feel, or I certainly have felt, it's like, well, what do I have to offer? And again, it's a notice of the individual and the gifts that each person has, and they're different, and they're all of value.
Yeah. And all of that in our Christian life is part of the same thing it is here. You have to be involved with your community. Even if it's just something like your next door neighbor is your community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't sit by yourself and be a Christian. And I don't mean you have to do, but it's through that give and take of personal interaction that you learn about yourself, that you have to stretch so you stay flexible and you don't become so brittle that you break. That's kind of what Abbess Hester did in a way. She walled herself around with a few people who let her do what she wanted, and so she became inflexible.
Yeah. Right. You know, and I've felt that in my own life too. It's like, you know, once you make the decision to engage and, you know, teach classes or do whatever, whatever that is, it always turns out to be a good thing. You know, I learn as much from other people as I teach them, I'm sure. And, it's mutual growth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be, I mean, and your teaching classes example is perfect, but it doesn't have to even be something like teaching classes. It can really just be, for a long time, I don't know what it is. You know, you go to church, you sit kind of in the same place all the time, so you see the same people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like one after the other, I'll have some elderly person who I feel like has been given to me for a time period. And it's only because you smile at them and they smile back or whatever. And then they sit near you one day and then you're saying hello before Mass. And then after Mass, you're talking a little. And pretty soon, they're yours. I mean, one lady, I was taking her to a Bible study we both went to.
Mm-hmm.
But this next lady, she would come and she would get her relatives to bring her from her nursing home because she was going to sit with us. And she would call me to tell me if she couldn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
And not that I needed her to call me and tell me, you know, but it was one of these things where they get these attachments and I'm like, oh, this little lady's gone now. And I'm like, oh, wait, I see the next one. She's come up and introduced herself twice to me, you know, and so that's part of being part of the community, too. I can't say I don't really want to take you to Bible study. I don't really want to sit and smile and talk to you. I don't really. And if I do it, and not only am I being rude, but I'm turning myself away from an opportunity to grow and learn something. And I get fond of those people.
Yeah. Yeah. As do I.
Yeah.
That's something I had to learn.
Yeah. Well, no.
You know, my introverted self could sit in the basement and watch Star Trek all the time.
Oh,
but,
me too.
You know, I think you need to be moved to do something, whatever that might be.
I won't sit with you to watch Star Trek. That would be too much human interaction, but we can do it separately.
Exactly. And we can tweet, right? So true.
And that's these ladies. I mean, I guess one of the things that makes this book fascinating, and in the way you're saying, is they're a microcosm of just not only because they're a cloistered community and so they're fascinating, but they're a microcosm of the Christian community in that way too.
Yeah, absolutely they are. And I think that that's, you know, not only in the novel, but in life.
Yeah.
I mean, the cloistered communities, the monasteries I've visited, they're almost like fuel. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like a prayer wheel or whatever, you know, it's energizing.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what I'm trying to say other than this is, you know, these lives are of great value and their lives are a gift to the rest of us,
right,
who kind of see this as some type of an ideal almost, that we're seeing them very clearly taking these steps, that in our own lives we're taking similar steps, but maybe we don't see them as clearly because it's not the only thing that's happening at the moment. You know what I mean?
Right, because we have different vocations. We vocations as parents and mm-hmm. married people or whatever, you know, whatever it is that we're doing. We're sanctified Christians wherever we are. So,
yeah.
But we're not there to just pray. And the thing is the other great thing about this book is, you know, you think about, oh, they're cloistered. Well, all they have to do is go and pray. And this, well, no, somebody's got to wash the dishes and sweep and clean gutters, and they're doing all that stuff too.
Yeah.
And
worry about the money.
Right. Worry about the money and mm-hmm. do all these things. And as well, when they're praying, that's like their job. And it doesn't mean that they, you know, go to it with sighs like it's drudgery, but that's not just sitting around doing the easy stuff. It's not eating bonbons and watching Star Trek, you know.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So,
Yeah. So one more thing I wanted to make sure I pointed out about the individual, because we need to talk about Philippa some more.
Mm-hmm.
But near the end of the book, she says, out of nearly 100 nuns, why should I be the only one?
I know.
That was Philippa's silent cry of anguish.
For Japan.
Yeah. And then it says, because you are the only one. The answer mm-hmm. did not need to be said. It filled the whole monastery. You know, it's almost a replay of Catherine getting elected abbess.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, is this really what you need from me? Because I am not, I don't want to do it. But yet this step is taken.
And, you know, I never thought about that in terms of, you know, when you said that, I had a flashback to, I've had a moment like that when, you know, I did that chirp retreat, and then you go through formation, and you put on the retreat for the next people.
Yeah.
And I wound up being the lay director, which is the person who leads the thing, where I felt a lot like Philippa going, I really thought I could just do the music. I don't want to do this. And it was like, everybody's like, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
You're going to be the leader. And I'm like, damn it. And I never learned so much about how you lead by serving as a Christian as I did during that time.
Mm.
I spent my whole time serving, and it was really good, and I didn't grudge it, and I know I sound like I do now, but when that thing about why me, why am I the only one, there was a point during this process of turning it over to the next team,
mm-hmm.
it was a point of discernment. It was discernment between two people. It was very grueling. It went on for hours. And I was the one who was having to tell other people in authority, no, we're going to go through this. No, I was, you know, they were sending me notes. I was writing no on them. And no, we're going to do this the way we have to. And at one point internally, I was like, why did this have to be me? And I am not kidding. Right into my head pops this, because I picked you. And I was like, oh, okay. Sorry.
All right, then.
As we were, everybody.
Heck yeah.
It's that same thing. It's like, you know, you don't get to ask why. You're here. And later I could look back and go, because I was the only one stubborn enough to stand up to all those people. And I was, and I would. And they all knew it. And so did God, evidently. I just do it. It's like, this
That's
is
right.
a big pain. I don't want to do this.
And so. that is, you know, in this novel, it's evident that, you know, the right people are constantly selected for the right jobs, even though you know, the person questions it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see fairly quickly how wise the decisions are. You know, once time moves on.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, exactly. And I really kind of loved the fact that, you know, Philippa thought she was going to go and be able to disappear into this place, first because she thinks she can sublimate her own personality, which is the thing I'm always wanting to do. Every time I go into any meeting, I'm always like, no, don't talk. Don't say a word. And when people hear that, they're like, oh, is that what you told yourself before you came in? I'm like, aren't you glad? It would have been much worse.
It would have been terrible. Oh, that's too good.
And then when it changes to the fact that it's really clear that the whole time there was this tapestry being woven that leads up to her being the only person who's going to be able to lead the Japanese nuns back and start the new convent there.
Yep, yep.
You know?
Yeah, it was
but
amazing.
But the whole step of the way, she has to be prepared by being able to hone off those sharp edges.
Yeah. Wow, what a book this is.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah, and Philippa, I mean, her whole story was amazing.
Yes.
You know, her doubts, we got to see her doubts.
Mm-hmm.
We got to see her growth. We got to see her fight several things. We got to see her, like you said, wishing that she was detached and still finding herself attached to the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
Through Penny, which was tragic.
That was really tough. Well, it's funny because I think of that whole thing differently now than I did when I first read it, but I was always struck by the force of Philippa saying, think again, you're not thinking straight. That wasn't a germ. That was a whole son or daughter.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the callousness of the guy.
He was selfish, and that's...
Yeah.
And she loved him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how those things happen.
Right.
But we got to see his redemption.
We did. Yep.
And that whole evening when they pray, all of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, Philippa's story is really, it's the core of the whole thing. And it's surprising how often the author goes away from it to talk about Cecily or Dame Catherine or Abbess Catherine or, you know, various other things going on. But then when you come back, Philip has always been there, kind of sublimated as she wanted to be. But then you start seeing the little stories that show she hasn't really been sublimated.
Yeah.
We just haven't been seeing what's going on with her right then.
Yeah, that's one of the things about this book that's so good is, like I said, I feel like that pacing just worked perfectly. I mean, that was really smart. There was more than one time I was like, well, what's going on with Philippa? You know, not that I was bored in any way, but it was like, where is she right now? I was very interested. And, you're right. The author just steps away and you're like, okay, she's living.
Yeah.
And I think that's really something how she did that.
Well, and that's that thing where it's the eddies that it's almost like, I think I wrote this on a comment on Goodreads when I was rereading this, is it's really just like, it's a big, her books, like this one anyway, tend to be just like this big river. And every so often you get swirled away into a little eddy off by the side, and then you get pushed back into the main part of the story. And that's how she does with time too, kind of get shunted away and then you get pulled back. I mean, to me, she's just such a beautiful writer.
Yeah, she really is. Yeah.
I don't know enough to be able to judge it really in the way that you properly judge, but for me, she just is lyrical.
Yeah, let me see if I can find... there's one spot here where she talks about Advent to Advent. I just wrote down the page number, but unfortunately I didn't mark where on the page. I'm looking here. Ba, 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 ba.
That's all right. You'll find it.
Yeah. Let's see. Each nun brought her list of names, the names of her own dead. The lists would lie on the altar all November in remembrance, as slowly as the year ebbed. In the gray November days once more, it seemed as if it would never wake again until, in that day, the voices rang out the new promise. Advent. The wheel had turned round again. Advent to Advent, spun continuously, Philippa wrote, but we nuns are the wheel. I just love that.
Oh, yeah, and you know, we forgot to say, when you said the voices rang out, this is a group of nuns, they sing all their masses.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a big emphasis on music and musical training, and, you know, like Philippa can't sing, so they have to teach her how to chant instead, so it goes along with everything. But that's very important to the background, the life of everything.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And did you get that? I emailed you something, the Benedictines of Mary.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Queen, yeah. Mm-hmm. They have an album called Advent at Ephesus that I saw Jeff Miller, Kurt Jester, just post about. And I went and listened and loved it. So I've got it. But
I'm trying to remember if I got, I think maybe I got Lent at Ephesus. Mm-hmm. But they've done several.
Yeah.
I have one of theirs. And then I got a couple more chant things that I have to listen to review. But all those I just love. They kind of just really,
yeah, they're wonderful.
Worldly, they just take you out of yourself.
Yeah, and it was neat to discover that while I was reading this book, because it would have been similar. These were Benedictine nuns as well.
Right.
And it's Advent now. So it's just like, how cool. Everything just kind of fits together. And I don't know if you knew, but this is the year of consecrated life just started with the beginning of Advent.
I did not know that. So
this
last
is a cool
Sunday.
Book to read right there.
Wow, that's how timely.
How timely, for
if
sure.
If only I'd have known. So we're going to have to go for the mysterious pushing.
Yes. How cool that is. Yeah, I love that.
I know. Well, I guess if you wanted to read a book with that emphasis,
this would be it. Yeah.
Book,
if you want to celebrate the year of consecrated life, here is a book you should read. No question.
Well, and the other thing is, I just want to get this in because I know we're kind of running out of things to talk about maybe, but I flipped this open tonight to start just kind of looking through and making notes for our conversation, and the very first paragraph of the prologue, when you read it, after having read the book, you just go, wow, how can this encompass the entire book so well? It says, the motto was Pax. But the word was set in a circle of thorns. Pax, peace, but what a strange peace, made of unremitting toil and effort, seldom with a seen result, subject to constant interruptions, unexpected demands, short sleep at nights, little comfort, sometimes scant food, beset with disappointments and usually misunderstood. Yet peace all the same. Undeviating, filled with joy and gratitude and love. It is my own peace I give unto you. Not, notice, the world's peace.
Hmm. Yep. So yeah, you don't need to go further than that to know that she's just a terrific writer.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, because then it goes right into Penny's point of view on it was New Year's Day and it was the last day that Philippa was there, but she didn't know it because it was, you know, revealed to her later. But when I look, so you look at that and you kind of read it and go, oh yeah, that makes sense. And then you read the whole book and you go back and look at it and go, wow, that's underlying the entire story. And yet it's like our own lives too, you know, if we're cooperating with Christ as best we can.
Yeah.
All those things, but still filled with joy and gratitude and love.
Right, right.
Because you know what? Life's like that anyway.
It is.
Life has all that effort. Life has a lot of things you do that you don't ever see a result to. You're constantly interrupted. You know, I don't know about the scant food or whatever, but you know, they're disappointments, you're misunderstood. Mm-hmm. Why not do that with somebody who can help you? And make it better in a way you never would have expected.
Yes, that's right. I'm with you.
Woohoo!
Yeah, so thanks for this book. Thanks for this
book. Oh, I'm so glad.
I was really thrilled to have read it.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah, yeah. Thumbs up. Another winner.
Well, it's a desert island book for me.
Yeah, yeah. And I can see why. I can certainly see why.
I was surprised because as I was going through it, and I know the story very well. I mean, I know all the main things that happened to people, but I was so pulled in again, and this has got to be my fifth or sixth time to read it. There were a couple places where I was crying over Philippa's story about her little boy.
Oh, that was really rough. Yeah.
Yeah.
Man.
Over Cecily's decision, and then over also something to do with the jet, maybe when she's deciding to go to Japan. But I just found myself very moved again, and I thought, wow, what kind of a great book is this? And in fact, I deliberately don't reread it too often because I don't want to, you know, lessen its impact on me in terms of just being able to love it.
Yeah. Yeah, I was moved several times. Yeah. A lot of the things that the characters went through, you know, I could understand. And that was neat.
Yeah.
It was great for me. This wasn't a book where I'm reading about people that I don't get. It was refreshingly right. about people that I understood. And it was terrific that way.
Yeah, because what we tend to forget is those people are all still people.
Yeah, yeah.
With all the good things and the bad things, you know, the faults and
right. The you know, all the things that we expect of our priests, you know. He's just a guy. He's just some guy, yeah. right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and sometimes we need to be reminded to treat him that way a little bit.
Yeah, and I have a friend who's really good about during these liturgical times of year, like Advent and Lent, when they have extra tasks, a lot of extra tasks, she always prays for them extra and That's often nice. Will ask if she can take on some of their exhaustion so they're freshened. And I'm like, I don't know how that works. Again, the beyond my understanding, but I'm like, how good of her to even think of it.
Right.
And after reading this book, you go, oh, I think they need it.
Absolutely right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow. Yep. Definitely a good one. Now I was going to ask you, do you know of a book about a priest or a group of priests that you would think would be good to read during the year of consecrated life?
I can't think of one off the top of my head.
Nothing's leaping to your head? Okay.
So,
somebody recommended to me one time a Morris West book, The Devil's Advocate. Have you read that?
Actually, that's the book I was just thinking when you said someone once recommended, and I went, oh, well, there is The Devil's Advocate.
That must be it. I have not read it. I have not read
it. For us to read sometime if we keep this going for 50 years and we get through all my books. I've read it twice. I got it as a review book, and I read it, and I liked it. And then our Catholic Women's Book Club read it. And, of course, as is always the case, when we were talking about it, it really enriched it for me. It's very good. Very good. It's cool. Not the same because he's, you know, a devil's advocate. He's out there investigating a case of possible sainthood.
I see.
But he himself has issues. So, you know, and so does everybody he runs into. So in that way, it's very much like this.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a terrific book.
Cool.
So I guess I do, along with whoever it was who...
Well, it may have been you. It may have been you.
I don't know. You would think that would have sprang to mind because I would have been pushing it on you so much. But
Gotcha. Well, cool. All right. So let's see. Next. Oh, Christmas time.
Oh, yeah.
It's a Wonderful Life is the film we're going to talk about.
I'm very excited.
Frank Capra.
Mm-hmm.
And then
that's another one.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that's another one I try not to watch too much so that I don't ruin it for myself.
Right. That's a good point. And then the new year begins. We'll be here back in 2015 on January the 14th is what we decided. And we're going to take the patron saint of this podcast. Flannery O'Connor is who we're going to start this year off with. Everything That Rises Must Converge. It's a short story collection.
That's perfect because that's beginning our fifth year. I feel like that's an anniversary, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's perfect.
Excellent. Yeah. So we'll talk some short stories. And then the 100th episode, special mystery guest.
I love that.
I'm reading it on the website. Fantastic.
I suddenly went, oh, you're reading the sidebar. Good job.
How cool. Well, I'm excited for our fifth year, but first, It's a Wonderful Life, and it definitely is.
Oh, me too.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's such a great movie.
Yeah, well, good.
And everyone needs to rewatch it unless they've done what I did a few years ago and watched it too much and had to stop.
You bet. All right.
So rewatch it so you're fresh.
Okay. You bet. All right, well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yes, have a great... Yeah, it'll be a couple of weeks.
Yeah,
just
a couple weeks, right.
I've been thinking about the schedule so much, I was thinking jumping ahead.
Right.
Yes, have a great couple of weeks, and definitely get something by Rumor Godden. If you don't get this book, get something else by her.
Cool.
Get an episode of Sparrows or something like that.
Ooh, an episode of Sparrows. You didn't mention that one.
I thought I did, but now I am.
Maybe you did.
Doesn't matter if I did. Just
an episode of Sparrows.
Yep.
Okay, cool. Got it.
Okay.
All right. See you later, everybody.
Stay warm, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye.